are listening to Preconceived, where we examine the preconceptions that shape how we view the world and the paradigms by which we live our lives. Hey everybody, I'm Zale Mednick, and welcome to another episode of Preconceived. The universe is, in many ways, a mystery. Just thinking about the scope and extent of the universe can be overwhelming, as its magnitude is tough to comprehend, and our place in it even more impossible to understand. Yet, for all we do not know, there is a lot that some experts do know in the fields of astronomy, astrophysics, and cosmology. With the recent discovery of biological life on Mars, where does our current knowledge of the universe stand in 2020? How vast is the universe? What do we know about extraterrestrial life? What do we know about planets? Are there likely worlds similar to our own that exist? And why is this all important? How does a better understanding of the universe at large actually influence our present lives on Earth today? Today I am joined on the podcast by astrophysicist Dr. John Asher Johnson. Dr. Johnson received his master's and PhD degrees in astronomy from the University of California, Berkeley. He then held a National Science Foundation postdoctoral fellowship in astronomy and astrophysics based at the Institute for Astronomy at the University of Hawaii. He is now a professor of astronomy at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. In 2013, he was named one of Astronomy Magazine's 10 Rising Stars in Astrophysics. His primary research focus is on the detection and characterization of planets outside our solar system, commonly known as exoplanets. His notable discoveries include three of the smallest planets discovered to date, each smaller than the Earth, and one the size of Mars. In addition, he has discovered over 100 other planets. He is also the founder and director of the Harvard Banneker Institute, a 10-week summer program designed as a graduate school preparatory program for students of color seeking to pursue a PhD in astrophysics. John, thank you so much for joining me.
No, you're welcome. It's good to be here.
I think that's the coolest introduction I've ever given, mostly that you've discovered planets. So that's pretty cool. You've discovered planets.
Yeah. I found lots of planets using lots of different techniques. I've worked with a lot of different, very talented astrophysicists and very outstanding research teams. And we live in an era of now we know thousands of planets, and I've had my contribution to those.
It's pretty incredible. You don't need me to tell you that. Being so embedded in this work on a daily basis, do you ever kind of pinch yourself and say, wow, this is really cool stuff I'm doing? Or is it just such a part of your life that it's like, found another planet this week?
I think that all people, to some degree or another, have something really remarkable going on in their lives. And you reach that point very gradually and slowly. So it's not like you wake up one morning and you're a planet hunter and you found planets. It's something that takes place over several decades. And so when I got started, apprenticed essentially as a graduate student, and started learning how to use telescopes and how to write computer code and how to figure out problems in astrophysics, that just one thing led to another. And eventually I found my first planet, which was really exciting. But then after that, it became both routine and really fun and exciting.
To begin, I kind of want to get your take on something that I don't think I'm alone in finding difficult to contextualize. How do we begin to understand the size of the universe? Like, the human mind is almost not capable of conceptualizing and understanding such a vast thing. So how do you look at it?
How do I look at the universe? I think that the only way that the human brain can really conceptualize the vast scale of the universe is to really think about it one part at a time. And so my research takes place within a tiny, tiny little pocket of the galaxy that we live in. And the galaxy is enormous. The galaxy alone is too big for your mind to wrap around. It contains tens of billions of stars. When I think about our galaxy by itself, I just think of what's known as the local solar neighborhood, the region about 30 light years in radius around the sun. And that is also enormous. That little radius is defined by the time it would take for light going at the speed of light to travel. It would take 30 years to reach the edge of that little bubble that I work within. So the way you do it is to not try to conceptualize the entirety of the universe unless you are thinking about a single phenomenon or some physical process, but don't think about all of it at once. It's impossible.
What is and this is a basic question, but I think a lot of listeners probably don't know, what is a galaxy exactly, and how many galaxies are there in the universe?
So if you've ever been to a dark site and had the pleasure of looking up and seeing the sort of white streak of light across the sky, that's the Milky Way. And what you're seeing is our galaxy, which is a collection of tens of billions of stars, hundreds of billions of stars. And they are all gravitationally bound into this flattened disk. And all of the stars are rotating around the center of that disk. And at the center of the disk is a supermassive black hole that contains the mass of about a million suns. And sort of dominates the central region of the galaxy and keeps everything together. Our galaxy, which is absolutely enormous, it is tens of thousands of light years across, just in radius. And we live sort of in the outer region of the galaxy. And as we ride around our sun, our Earth goes around the sun. Well, our sun is orbiting the center of our galaxy. The Milky Way is part of a local collection of galaxies. It's a 10-ish or so of them in our local group. And those galaxies are all gravitationally bound to one another. And then our local group of galaxies is part of the overall universe, which contains tens of billions of galaxies just within the part of the universe that we can see with the light emitted from galaxies far away. Beyond that horizon, there's probably hundreds of billions of more galaxies.
So tens of billions of galaxies in the universe as we know it. When you talk about light years, which I think is it's a fascinating concept, which really illustrates how the brain is not able to think about how the vastness of the universe in normal time units. How many light years would it take to reach the end of the universe as we know it?
I guess we can see out to as far as light has had time to travel to us. And that amount of time is set by the age of the universe. So 14 billion years old.
Wow.
So we can see out to about 14 billion light years. Beyond that, anything that emits light beyond 14 billion light years away, and it's actually larger than that because the universe is expanding and all these extra complications, but anything beyond that bubble where we can actually see things, light just hasn't had enough time, even going the speed of light, it hasn't had enough time to traverse that distance for us to see.
So when you're seeing something that's 14 billion light years away, let's say,
yeah,
if you're seeing something, that light is being emitted from something that emitted it 14 billion years ago.
Yep, that thing does not exist anymore as it is that we see it. It has changed over the 14 billion years that the first light signals that were emitted have gotten here. So as you look further and further out in space, you are also looking further and further back in time.
And when you say our universe is expanding and we don't even know how big our universe really is, do you anticipate that with time, as technology becomes more advanced even than what it is, we'll be able to continue to be able to quantify how much bigger it is?
We're not going to actually be able to see, because the only thing you can do is wait for that light to get here. And that's just, you know, over the course of human existence, the entirety that humans have been human, which is something like, you know, a million years, that radius has not changed much at all. So what we see of the universe is what we will ever see of the universe. Now, that doesn't mean that we can't understand more about it, because all of that light carries with it information about the nature of the universe. It carries with it information about the rate at which the universe is expanding, It carries information about what stars and galaxies looked like back in the earliest times of the universe. And so what we can do as astronomers is we can use those light signals to piece together clues and evidence to support various hypotheses about the nature of the universe. And so even though we can't see beyond that visible horizon, we can perhaps gather more clues about what might exist out there.
A lot of your work is obviously in planets, mm-hmm. which I think is awesome and really cool, as I've yeah. made clear. So what is a planet, and what is the significance of discovering a planet?
So yeah, we have now gone from the edge of the universe down into the local solar neighborhood where I know things. The significance of finding planets around other stars, first of all, when the first extrasolar planets outside the solar system, were discovered about 25 years ago, the significance of that is that humans simply did not know if the planets of our solar system were the only examples of planets that existed in the entirety of the universe. And so when the first planets around other stars were discovered, we immediately had a broader context of what it means to be in a solar system, what a planet is, the nature of planets, how they might have formed. A planet is defined by a gravitationally bound object that is massive enough such that gravity pulls equally on all parts of it to make it a sphere. Objects like asteroids are shaped like potatoes because they're not massive enough to take on a more spherical shape. Another thing that distinguishes a planet from other objects that might be in orbit around a star is that, well, actually, that's another thing, is that a planet orbits a star. So there's a central radiating body around which this gravitationally bound thing orbits. And as it orbits, a planet has to basically be in charge of its local environment such that it is not also orbiting some other more massive object. So the moon is spherical, and the moon orbits around the sun, but the moon also is not in charge of its little neighborhood. The moon is dominated by the gravitational pull of the Earth, and therefore the moon is a moon and not a planet. All of these are just more or less arbitrary ways of classifying big things that orbit even bigger things. And it's just a handy way of kind of keeping track of what it is that we are seeing. It's not really some hard and fast rule or law of nature. It's just a way of humans trying to keep track of things. When these definitions get modified such that, for example, Pluto no longer is considered a planet, it's not that the physical nature of Pluto was suddenly changed or altered. It's, you know, Pluto's still Pluto. And so if any human being wants to look at Pluto and say, nope, that's a planet, then you are not incorrect. That's a really important thing to keep in mind. This is just simply a classification scheme.
So Pluto, when it was deemed not a planet scientifically, there was just more information that came to light, no pun intended, but more information that came to light that said, this isn't orbiting the sun as independently as the other planets, for example. There's external factors affecting its orbit.
Yeah, it was just reclassified, but the object Pluto is still out there, and it's still fascinating, and it still captures the imaginations of humans back here on Earth just the same. And it's also, now that the reclassification has happened, it opens up fun creative space for memes and arguments and stuff like that online.
I like how memes made its way in there.
Yeah.
So in your work, what draws you and a lot of people then to planets specifically? Is it that it's the most relatable thing because we are on a planet?
Yeah, that's a big part of it. Planets are the only locations within the universe that we believe life can inhabit. So you can't have life just floating about in interstellar space. We don't believe that life can exist on little dust grains floating around. We know that life cannot exist on the surface of a star. It's far too hot. Life can't be around a black hole or a neutron star or something like that. Planets are the only sites on which life can exist. And so discovering planets around other stars opens up the possibility that we might find the existence of life outside of the solar system. There's also just the question of context. I liken it to when you're a child and you grow up in, let's say, a suburban neighborhood or even an urban neighborhood, just wherever it is that you're a child and you grow up. The first thing that you know of is your bedroom and maybe the living room and the kitchen of your house. And then you might start exploring your house a little bit more. And as a human being, you're curious. And that really satisfies something really deep and innate and defining about what it is to be a human, is to further discover and have agency over your environment. Then you might leave your house and you start realizing, oh, there's other houses, there's other apartments in this apartment complex, there's other houses in my cul-de-sac or my neighborhood. And then you might eventually reach the age where you can hop on your bicycle and you can start exploring your neighborhood, and you realize, oh, wow, there's this entire collection of houses and it's inside this thing called the neighborhood. And now I have more context about the nature of my house. My house is medium sized or big or small or whatever. It's tall, it's low and narrow or whatever. And you start having this just deeper understanding of what it means to live in your world. And then eventually you might make it out to the airport and hop on a plane and travel to other cities, other locations, and you start realizing just how big the country is. And then you start realizing there's other countries. Well, the same sort of things happens on a galactic scale or scale of the universe, is that we know of our solar system. That's where we live. That's our home. We first learned about the Earth and then the night sky. And in the night sky, we saw other planets and we started figuring out we're part of a solar system. And for a long time in human existence, for hundreds of years, that's all we knew about, was that we were one planet within a collection of planets called the solar system, and we orbited the sun, which is a star. But we could also see that there were other stars out there. And so that naturally opened up the question of, are there other solar systems? And so we now know that absolutely there are billions of other solar systems out there, and that solar systems like our own, collections of planets that orbit stars, are very common. They're actually ubiquitous throughout the universe. It's very unusual. It would be very unusual to find a star, another sun, that did not have planets. And just having that context is deeply satisfying for us as curious sentient beings. And so it's exciting when we expand that knowledge.
And is a lot of the work done in this area, it is super interesting, which is why lots of people love talking about it. But does it have practical applications when we learn about the universe the way that people like you are doing? Are there practical applications that affect our lives beyond a theoretical level?
No. Yeah. Absolutely not. To be perfect, I mean, this is my job. This is what I love to do. It's a wonderful thing to keep doing. I really hope that NASA and the National Science Foundation keep giving me funding to do it. And also, it's really important, I think, for us as astronomers to be very honest and say that beyond satisfying human curiosity, which is important, there is no real practical application to the knowledge of planets around other stars. It's not going to help us solve the problems that we as a species are currently facing. And those problems are existential. Those problems are immense, and it is an emergency that we solve the problems of global warming, degradation of biodiversity, the complete destruction of the habitability of the only planet that we ever have hope of inhabiting. And so our knowledge of other planets is not at all going to help us with those problems right now that we're facing. I think that once we solve those problems and we find a way of living sustainably and in harmony with our environment, then astronomy becomes this really important on an emotional and sort of human level, but really also kind of a luxury.
I like your honesty, and that makes a lot of sense. I think some people, when they watch, and I'm not even going to take myself out of it, I'm pretending like I have this superior knowledge than the basic population, but I don't. I think a lot of people, when they watch movies or they read science fiction and they think about what the future could be like, that future of travel between planets, that's not the purpose of this. That potential purpose of finding other planets to inhabit, that is not what this is about. That is so remote.
The fact of the matter is, right now, the systemic structure of the way that humans presently live, with its market economy and its continual pressure to keep expanding at all costs, even human costs, is such that we presently, at the current rate of consumption of natural resources, in order to be sustainable going into the future, we need two other Earths. We need two entire additional Earths to continue to consume. And then after those are consumed, we're going to need additional planet-sized collections of resources. And that's completely unsustainable. Mm-hmm. So even if we had the ability to travel to another Earth that we found around some other nearby star, unless we address the way that our society is structured, we would just simply get there, consume it within a few hundred years, and then need to go to another. And that is completely unsustainable. It's not something that allows human beings to continue to exist within the universe.
What's the sustainability like currently on Earth, the way we're using it in terms of our...
It's not sustainable. That the current level of sustainability is not sustainable. The way that our socioeconomic political system operates is that we are facing an existential crisis, full stop. And I think the structure is so embedded that human beings know this. We know this based on all available science, and yet it can't be stopped within the structure as it exists. My view, and based on the knowledge of, you know, present degradation of the habitability of our Earth, is that we need to go to zero emissions like 10 years ago. We're well past the breakpoint. We are not sustainable right now.
And any quantification of how much longer the Earth has at this current level, or is that too difficult to predict?
It looks like there's a convergence of a lot of different problems that is looking like on 1 to 2 decade timescales that it'll be irreversible, and that perhaps within our lifetime we won't have a habitable planet. And to me, that's heartbreaking, and it also is a call to action. And so my hope is that there is an opportunity in the near future for a radical restructuring of the way that our society operates, such that we can return to what humans have done over the vast majority of our million year existence on Earth, which is to live in harmony with our planet rather than to live in a state of exploitation.
I think it's really important for people to hear you say that, because you are a scientist,
mm-hmm.
knows about this, obviously. And I don't want to make this political, but I was watching, and I'm not sure when this will air. This episode will probably come out after there's a new president. But during the presidential and vice presidential debates, there was talk about climate change, and there was talk about the science of it. And there was a conversation between Kamala Harris and Pence, where Pence was kind of hesitant to acknowledge the scientific truth of some facets of climate change. And Trump certainly hasn't been somebody who has been very receptive to the realities of scientists, to the point that when you're listening, you question, oh, am I drinking the wrong Kool-Aid? Is this not a real issue? But my point is, you're saying, as somebody who is overly qualified to be talking about this, that yes, this is a very real problem.
It is an absolute, yeah. It is an existential crisis. And so I look, the longstanding, the stance of the Republican Party and the far right in our country has always been in a state of denial about the problem of anthropomorphic climate change. And keep in mind that climate change is only one of the existential crises that we face. The other crises that we face are things like ocean acidification based on the erosion of topsoil. We have biodiversity that is just in rapid decline. We have industrial agriculture that is reducing the variety, the diversity of foodstuffs that we have available as those things become ever more commodified and owned by large corporations. And then we also have to face the fact that the vast nuclear arsenal of the United States has never really been under control. So the United States exists in a world in which it is one of several nuclear superpowers, and any single one of those weapons, if it's unleashed, will destroy the Earth. Let's just face the fact that the Republicans in the far right in our country have zero interest in solving any of these problems. And let's take a look at what's going on in the supposed left. The Democrats also have no real interest in addressing these things. Our entire political establishment really has no real interest in addressing these problems. And to the extent that we had a single question in the first presidential debate and we had another question that come up in the vice presidential debate, those questions were not going to be a part of the program until there was a massive push from the populace in our country and around the world that says that we must start talking about these things. But it was not the default of our present political system. So I think that it is not a Democrat versus Republican issue right now. It is a humanity versus the present political economic system.
Yeah, and it's scary, especially when you put it into terms thinking about decades. John, I want to shift gears a little bit to the notion of what could potentially exist on these planets.
Yeah, let's talk about planets. Let's get off of ours.
Yeah, exactly. Let's get away from here.
Yeah.
Though it's fascinating. It's very fascinating hearing your perspective on these things because of the space you work in. These puns are all accidental and awful. I apologize to everybody who's had to listen to them. So there's something called the Drake equation. So it's a probabilistic equation used to estimate the number of extraterrestrial civilizations in the Milky Way galaxy. Mm-hmm. What does the Drake equation tell us in terms of the probability that there are other civilizations that live on other planets? Because it's a really interesting question. Are we the only people that live in this universe?
Yeah.
Or is it such a silly question to people who are like you, who know the extent of the planets that are out there, where you're just saying, oh, absolutely, it's not a question of if, it's how many?
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, so the Drake equation is not, first of all, it's really important to note that it's not a fundamental law of the universe. It's just simply a construct that was assembled to try to get a handle on, you know, whether it's even possible for life to exist elsewhere in the universe within our galaxy. And so it starts off with, if there are no other planets in existence in the entire galaxy or the entire universe, then the probability that there's other life is zero. So once you start finding that there exist other planets, then you've removed that hurdle that would push the probability of other life to zero. But once you found other planets, let's just say that the only other planets that you knew to exist were Jupiter-like planets, gas giants without a solid surface. Well, then again, you just push the probability to zero again, because there's no place for life to conceivably live. But then if you found that there were other Earth-sized planets out there, now you're like saying, okay, now you're telling me there's hope. Now you're telling me there's an opportunity for life to exist somewhere. But if all of those planets existed parked right next to their star and were getting blasted with stellar irradiation, and their atmospheres were going to get destroyed by the intense UV light from their central star because they're so close to it, or if all of those planets existed so far from their central stars that all of the water that might exist on their surface is completely frozen, well, again, you're going to push everything to zero. But if you start telling me that there are planets that exist that are, first of all, rocky and have solid surfaces and thin atmospheres, and that they exist in just the right distance away from their stars that they can have liquid water, now, again, you're saying that there's hope. There's the possibility that there could be life in the galaxy. And so when I started off as a graduate student, we knew that there were planets around other stars, but the only planets we knew of were gas giant planets that were right next to their stars, not like our Jupiter, where they're 5 times the distance of the Earth away from the central star. Instead, these gas giant planets were in orbits that lasted only a few days. So they're extremely hot. They're right next to their stars. And we didn't know of any planets that might have rocky surfaces. But today, using new techniques for finding planets and surveys that are dedicated to the discovery of planets in the solar neighborhood, we know that there are that rocky planets are everywhere. They exist probably around every single star. And that those rocky planets have a wide variety of distances away from their central stars. So there's a possibility that they exist in the so-called habitable zone, the Goldilocks zone. And so these probabilities have been pushed away from zero and into the chance that there could exist life. And once we get to that point where we start talking about there being the possibility that there are planets that could contain life, it's important to distinguish between bacterial life that exists in, you know, large mats along the surface of water, underneath the surface of water, or even things like plants. You have to distinguish those from intelligent life. So intelligent life would be something that, you know, sentient beings that have the ability of communicating with us. And so I would say that given our present day knowledge of planets and their ubiquity in the galaxy, that it's got to be an absolute certainty that there exists life outside of the solar system. I really have no reason at all to doubt that, even though I don't have positive evidence to back that. I don't have any reason to doubt it. But when it comes to the existence of intelligent life, that's another question entirely. There is evidence right now to back the notion that we are the only civilization of intelligent communicative beings in the galaxy. That's a distinct possibility. Again, I think it's sort of unlikely, but there are some weird bits of evidence, such as why haven't we heard from anybody? But that's a different question entirely than the question of, is there life elsewhere in the universe?
In terms of intelligible life, and I know it's a different pathway, a different line of questioning, but do people in astronomy ever think about what it would be like if we did have a different civilization come visit us on Earth and the kinds of problems that might present?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's pretty well explored in science fiction. And I think science fiction is actually getting more and more sophisticated in the way that it considers what that life might be like. I think the problems that you encounter, from my perspective, is to just simply think about intelligent life here on our planet and imagine what it would be like for us human beings as intelligent life to go back, let's say, 1,000 years, just 1,000 years. Take you and your iPhone and your laptop and a few other artifacts of modern day technology and go back 1,000 years and start talking with people back then. And I think, you know, what those people would be looking at when they see you and your technology would quite literally blow their minds. They would have no real immediate way of even understanding what it is that they're looking at if you were to hold your iPhone up to them. That's just a difference in 1,000 years. You know, rewind the clock 10,000 years now, and now try to interact with a human being from 10,000 years ago. The problem gets even further amplified. They just don't even know exactly what it is that they're looking at. I mean, they know that they're looking at a human. But what is this human holding? What is this human doing with the technology that they have? And so that's a change of only 10,000 years. If you consider the fact that the Earth is 4 billion years old, you consider the fact that the universe is 14 billion years old, imagine some civilization that got started as intelligent beings, sentient beings, developing technology 1 million years ahead of us. And now we encounter them. The technology that they have would be indistinguishable from magic. We would not know what exactly it is that we're even interacting with. And on the flip side, we as human beings who got started 1 million years after this other intelligent species, this other intelligent civilization, we would just look completely primitive to them. We would look a lot like us seeing a bunch of meerkats or something. You know, you would just be like these really unintelligent, primitive little beings. And that's only a difference of 1 million years. Imagine an intelligent species that developed civilization 1 billion years ago. And think about what technology they would have. There's just absolutely zero way that we would know what it is that we're looking at. What is this phenomenon that exists in front of us? And so that's what I think about when it comes to, you know, a lot of science fiction revolves around us encountering intelligent beings that maybe only have like 100-year head start. And even that is daunting because they have spaceships that hover and shoot lasers or something like that. Ooh, you know, that's a delta of like 100 years. Well, take the delta of 1 billion years and now you got real problems in interacting with this intelligent civilization.
And which is very feasible, it sounds like, that does exist given the scope of the universe and given kind of those statistics you just talked about, that life does exist.
It's totally conceivable that there was a planet that formed around a star 1 billion years ahead of our planet forming around our star. And then life evolved on that planet and then became intelligent. They became sentient. They became curious. They started building a civilization. And maybe they initially started communicating and sending radio waves, but you know, then only 100 years after that, they realized, oh, this is a really inefficient way of communicating. There's actually this fifth dimension that exists within space that we have access to, and we'll just communicate along that fourth or fifth dimension outside of space and time. And maybe that's actively happening all around us, and we're just so primitive in our understanding of the structure of space and time that we don't know about that other dimension and we have no access to it. And so we're just completely missing the fact that there are vast webs of extraterrestrial life that are communicating, traveling, interacting with one another, and we're just so primitive that we simply don't see any of it. That's well within the realm of possibility, because just again, think back to the way humans were 100 years ago. We were stuck on the surface of this planet 100 years ago. We were not even in orbit around our planet. We were completely confined to the surface. Rewind the clock 200 years ago, and there was no radio communication. There was no any radiation of intelligence coming from our planet's surface. And so change that difference to 1 billion years, and now you have something that is unrecognizable to us.
Do any of the stories, news things about UFOs coming hold any, or not coming, UFOs that we have actually identified? Because it's a really great point that there might be stuff we have no idea what we're even looking at. Probably is.
UFO is a really apt term. The first word of that is unidentified. It just says that is an object that is flying, and I don't know what it is. And so are those out there? Absolutely. There's all kinds of stuff that is zipping through our atmosphere that we do not know what it is. And that's just, it could be simply a limitation of our scientific understanding of the laws of nature in the universe. Or it could just be technology that is 10 years ahead of what we're familiar with that has been held secret from us. And so the military is doing some experiment up there. Or it could be beings from another planet. I can't rule that out, but I also don't think it's particularly likely.
This episode of the Preconceived Podcast is brought to you by Speaker Labs. Warren Buffett once said that the number one most important skill in business is public speaking. Speaker Labs helps people become rockstar public speakers. Most people think public speaking is a unique skill that only a select few possess. At Speaker Labs, they disagree. To them, public speaking isn't a unique skill set. It's a unique context for a skill that all humans already possess, communication. If you can communicate, you can public speak. All you need to do is change the way you think. Speaker Labs will show you how. They've trained teams at some of Canada's top companies, including RBC, Shopify, and Wealthsimple. Go to speakerlabs.ca to learn more. Is your personal worldview, is your view shaped by your understanding of astrophysics in terms of the value of human life? like when you, do you find it difficult at times to exist and find meaning in the world? And I sound super pessimistic asking this question, but
no,
knowing
not at all,
knowing the minuscule place that we hold in this universe, which is really, 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 really infinitesimally tiny.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I spoke earlier about the existential threats to the existence of humans and life on our planet. And on a galactic scale, or the scale of our entire universe, it just simply doesn't matter. If humans go extinct, if life on our planet goes extinct, it has zero consequence for the shape, the form, the nature, the evolution of the rest of the universe. It doesn't matter at all. And that could sound really bleak, but you got to remember that we are living beings. We are living, sentient beings. And when you just reduce the scale on which you're thinking away from the galaxy, away from the solar neighborhood, away from the rest of the solar system, you just look at the fact that I'm a human being and I want to continue living. As a human being, I know that it's better to be alive than it is to be dead. As a human being, I know it's better for my children to have the hope of existing in a world in which their basic needs are met and they can have happiness. It's better to have that outcome than to have an outcome where there's no more life. So what matters to me as a human is what matters to me as a human, not what matters to me as a human who understands the vast scale of the universe.
Because at the end of the day, it's all our... all we live with is our personal experience, and that is confined right now to the reality of this earth.
And that's okay. It is totally okay for us to be selfish about that. In fact, we need to be increasingly more selfish about the idea that it is important for us to continue living in the future. And otherwise, let's just stop now, you know. But I'm not ready to do that. And I don't know of a single human being that's really, really willing to say, yeah, let's just end it all now because it doesn't matter. I understand the vastness of the universe, and I understand how insignificant human beings are on that scale. So let's just end it. That's just not a perspective that I've encountered, and it's not something I'm familiar with. It really matters to me that as a human being, I can continue living until my life is finished. Naturally, not as a part of a catastrophe.
A lot of people, I think, who are very religious might struggle with these issues a little bit more because of the notion that the earth is so small relative to everything else. But do you view religion and science as mutually exclusive?
No, not at all. No. Like we don't have to look at it simply as religion. We just have to look at it as spirituality.
Yeah.
And spirituality, whether it's in the context of a specific religion or not, is really about our connection as human beings to the world around us. We are completely inseparable from the rest of what happens on this planet. That's why, like, all of this discussion about, you know, this billionaire or that wanting to go and colonize Mars, I think is absolutely ridiculous. Or the idea that we can make gigantic, vast space stations on which humans can now live completely disregards the fact that we are inextricably linked. Our essence, our life, our existence, our way of knowing, our way of being a human is completely and utterly entwined with everything else that happens on this planet. And the idea that you can just simply remove us from it and then still remain human, I think reveals a very fundamental misunderstanding of the nature of our lives as human beings. And so until that question is addressed, I'm not prepared to say, oh yeah, let's just go live on Mars or let's go live on some space station. My spirituality, my understanding of my connection to every other human, to every other life form, to every thing that is on this planet says that that's just not possible in any meaningful way. What our civilization does not presently do enough of is to really consider carefully what it means to be a human in the context of our planet.
That's a really refreshing perspective. And I often wonder when people point to the Big Bang Theory, poo-poo the idea of this spirituality, but at the end of the day, we don't know everything still. There's a ton of mysteries still. We don't know what created that big bang.
Yeah, and this idea that because we have some mechanistic description of how it is that our universe formed, and then to say that, like, because we have that little baseline information that we understand the entirety of humanity is absolutely ridiculous. And it's really just a product of Western society and Western thinking, which is based on the idea that it's possible for humans to exist separate from our environment. And indeed, not only to exist separate from it, but to dominate it, to exploit it for our continued existence without regard to sustaining it. That's a pathological way of thinking that is extremely new within the vast existence of humanity. Over the million years that humans have existed, it's only the last little snap of the finger in which we've had this weird notion that humans can be removed from the environment around us and dominated. And that thinking has seeped into the way that we do our science as well. We have a cartoon picture that describes the expansion of the universe. Congratulations. That does not mean that you understand the universe and all of its complexity. It just means that you have a hand-wavy description of part of it in its origins.
And I think that might be one of the bigger preconceptions that's easy to be trapped into, believing that we know more than we actually do, or mistake knowledge for true understanding of what life is, what this world is.
Yeah. Yeah. Or what it means to be a human. The hubris of it is almost mind-boggling. But it's ubiquitous within the realm of science. And I keep encountering it, and just causing me, you know, just the more I learn about myself spiritually, the more and more confused and baffled that I get about the behavior of scientists within our society. But then again, I feel that about our society at large.
The last thing I want to ask you about, John, is the Banneker Institute, which you run. So I mentioned at the beginning of the episode that you're the first African-American physical science professor in the history of Harvard University that received tenure.
Yeah, there's some caveats to that. Let's just put it this way. There are four Black professors in the sciences here, and there have only ever been four of us.
Wow. I was going to ask you next, what is the state of diversity? obviously not high.
Yeah, there is no diversity. There's no racial diversity within Western science. Yeah, there's no racial diversity within the American academic system. And that is a symptom of a larger societal problem that I think a lot of people, particularly people that consider themselves liberal, consider themselves on so-called political left, that every time they encounter bits of evidence like this, anytime I tell them that there are four Black scientists at Harvard, there's only ever been four Black scientists at Harvard, they always get taken aback, like, oh my, really? And I look at it and say, how did you not know that? I mean, when was the last time that you looked around and saw anyone other than Neil deGrasse Tyson as a prominent Black scientist within our country? It doesn't speak anything to the nature of Black people. Or it says everything about the larger society in which Black people exist. And it says everything about what it means to be Black in our country. We are humans. I've never encountered a child, no matter how poor, what part of the country they've grown up in, what city they've grown up in. I've never found a child that was not fascinated about the Big Bang, black holes, planets around other stars. But I have seen again and again and again when that child grows up and they try to, you know, they have the audacity to step into the field of science and try to pursue that knowledge within our present academic system. I've seen again and again that they find in the end that this isn't worth it. This isn't worth the trouble. This isn't worth the, you know, essentially the spiritual violence that occurs when you are forced to conform to a system that was built for and by white men. And so the Banneker Institute and our summer program that we run for students of color is to simply provide those students with, that had the audacity to say, I want to understand how the universe works. I want to study cosmology. I want to study extrasolar planets. Is to take those students and to give them just one summer where they get to pursue that knowledge within an environment that not only welcomes them, but that affirms their humanity on a day-to-day basis and says, you belong. You belong just as any other human being belongs. And even though you might return back to your home institution and be the only black or brown face within your astronomy department, we also have now connected you with others around the country who have the same exact experiences as you and are willing to stand in support of you and willing to be there and available to you when you encounter the problems that you encounter. And so far, we've had about 50 students, I think, in total that have come through the Institute over the past 6 years. And they now have the social support that Black and Brown students have never had before as they try to pursue knowledge within the sciences.
Well, congratulations. I think that's an incredible initiative. You don't need me to tell you that. And
thank you.
It's incredibly important. And it's just very apt to speak about that now in light of everything that's going on in the States and this conversation. The word conversation doesn't do it justice in terms of what's going on right now, but this conversation that's going on about racial injustices, and it's important to hear how it affects really every facet of American life.
I think what you're seeing nationally right now is moving the discourse away from simply talking about diversity, which is like looking around and saying, oh, there's the symptom. Maybe we should try to change the symptom. That is analogous to saying that in the era of COVID, maybe people should stop coughing. People should stop having sore throats. People should stop exhibiting the symptoms of COVID. That's ridiculous. Like, the problem is the existence of this virus. This sickness, the illness itself is the problem. And that needs to be addressed through a vaccine. It needs to be addressed by having better policies and keeping the spread of the disease down, maybe early detection, things like that. But you can actually see the two problems mirror one another. On the one hand, we have this pandemic that's just still raging out of control because we are simply not addressing the problem of a communicable virus. That's the issue, not the symptoms, not the people getting sick. Those are the symptoms. And in academia and within every other aspect of our society, is not the problem of there being a lack of diversity. That's like coughing. That's a symptom. The problem is the racism that's embedded into the fabric of our society, and that needs to be addressed. That needs to be rooted out and changed fundamentally before you're going to start seeing actual diversity take place as a consequence of taking those actions. And so what's happening nationally is a shift in the conversation, hopefully away from this weird sort of red herring discussion around diversity. Is diversity good? Is diversity bad? Should we have more diversity, or is the current level of diversity enough? That's ridiculous. And now we have marches in the streets that are pointing directly to the problem itself. And I really hope that that movement continues to gather steam and continues to push for not just reform, but a complete and fundamental reshaping of our society.
And so do I, and I think that's extremely well articulated. John, where can people learn more about you or look up some of your research, which I'm sure they probably won't even be able to understand because it's too intelligent?
Well, I think what you can do, if you would love to, you know, have a quick, easily digestible understanding of how we find planets around other stars, is to do a YouTube search for Exoplanets Explained. It's a beautifully animated 8-minute little short film done by Jorge Cham of PhD Comics. He and I collaborated about 10 years ago to put together a video to explain how it is that we find planets around other stars.
Well, that's great. And that's something we didn't, with all the things we got into today, we didn't even get into that, but I will find that YouTube link and put it into the episode notes so everybody listening can take a look at that.
Yeah.
John, thank you so much. You're a rare guest. I love all my guests, but you really, you've spoken about more than I expected to. You've combined your factual knowledge about the universe with deep insights into humanity existential issues and relevant issues that affect our lives today, like global warming, politics, and racism. And that's, it's rare to have that all in one episode. And I think that obviously speaks towards the person you are. So I'm so, so grateful you took this time to chat with me.
Yeah, it's, I've enjoyed having this conversation and hope your listeners enjoy it.
I'm sure they will. And thank you, everybody, for listening to this episode of Preconceived. If you're enjoying the podcast, please do rate and review us on whatever podcasting platform you use. That really helps with exposure of the show. And have a great day. Thank you for listening to Preconceived. Please subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast platform you use, and be sure to rate and review us. We'll see you next time.